Hi, everybody. My name is Red Aldridge. I'm an alcoholic. The grace of God and you guys, it has not been necessary for me to pick up a drink of alcohol, a tranquilizing, sedating, elevating pill. I haven't had to smoke any funny grass since the second day of December 1962. I want to thank the committee and also Chris and his lovely wife Jamie, stuck around Fayetteville, picked us up at a late airplane. Also Sam Davis, your chairman committee. I when you get a request to speak in the South and it comes from Sam Davis, you kind of feel like it's a special occasion. And I thought Sam was probably somebody really special. And yesterday morning, he proved he's one of us. He showed up at the morning meeting in a beautiful blue sports coat. And I realized that he had forgot to stop by the cleaners to get his pants. It's been a really, really beautiful weekend. Truly springtime in the Ozarks. I really enjoyed the countdown to see how many new people there were in this room, and also those that stood up and celebrated their birthdays. If you are new or fairly new and you're wondering why we do that on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, those birthdays are strictly for you. Because that way, even if you deny what you hear in rooms like this, you can't deny what you see. There's no way in the world that I ever try to stand up here at a podium and tell anybody in this room this morning whether they're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you have to start identifying with some of these innermost feelings I'm going to try to describe, some of these symptoms of this terminal disease that I have, I would sure as hell pay attention. Because what we're dealing with here is a terminal disease. Just roll that over your tongue a couple of times. That's got kind of a final ring to it. Means that if you continue to use and abuse the mind-altering drug alcohol, and don't let anybody ever kid you that alcohol is not a drug. Alcohol falls right in the drug category with ethers and anesthetics. It's one of the oldest known drugs to man, and it's probably been used and abused by man longer than any other drug. And for sure, it's killed more men and women than any other drug. I used it, and I abused it, over a period of time, regardless of how long it took, until I actually broke my tolerance to it. And if you're new or fairly new and you're wondering why alcohol has been giving you so much trouble physically, it's because you've become allergic to the drug alcohol. When old Red drinks alcohol, I break out in spots. Spots like Acapulco, Las Vegas. In other words, once I pick up the first drink of that mind-altering drug, I can no longer predict my behavior. And if you've been having trouble along those lines, I'll guarantee you that this morning you're in the right place. This physical allergy that I developed to this drug is not necessarily what makes it the killer that it is today. There's a mental side of this disease, and it's the real serious one. It's called the obsession of the mind. And it's triggered, incidentally, by the first drink of that mind-altering drug that you pick up that tells you that this time it's going to be different. This is the time I'll be able to predict. This is the time I'll be able to control. This is the time it's going to work for me like it always used to. See, if you be alcoholic like Red, and you pick up that first drink, you trigger your obsession to drink. Any alcoholic, it immediately sets up a compulsion to drink, and you're going to end up maybe not today, maybe not even this week. But once you trigger that obsession, once you set up that compulsion, you're going to end up in another devastating bout with this mind-altering drug, in which you're just one step closer to that insanity and death that they talk about when they read that portion of chapter 5 before these meetings. So the whole idea, the whole concept of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new or fairly new, is to teach us on a daily basis how to stay away from that first drink. You know, the first 100 guys and a gal that were able to do this on this fellowship, a day at a time, for a year, got together and they wrote down what they had done. They called it the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I gotta believe that that first 100 guys and a gal had to be spiritually led. Because over a period of the last 31 years that Red has been sober a day at a time, I have never found myself in a situation that I couldn't find the solution to in that Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was necessary for me to go out there and pick up that first drink. And almost all the answers come in those 12 suggested steps when they read from that portion of chapter 5. Those are the suggested steps to recovery used by that first 100 guys and a gal that were able to stay sober a day at a time for a year. If you're paying any attention at all when they're read, they are suggested steps to recovery. But I can guarantee that there's not a guy or a gal in this meeting this morning with any length of sobriety at all that ever had them just suggested to them. You're going to have to take them. You're going to have to do the best you can with them on a daily basis for the rest of your life if you want to become a survivor. Take a look around you in a room like this morning, and what you see are the survivors of a terminal disease, a disease from which there is no cure. Progressive disease is going to continue to get worse for the rest of your life, whether you drink or not. If you wonder why Red's standing up here this morning still yapping about the same old thing after 31 years of sobriety, it's because it's a hell of a lot more important for me to stay sober today than when I was in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. You see, my disease has continued to progress. Ellen and I had a very dear friend try it not too long ago with 22 years. That lady started to drink at 10 in the morning, and by 4 that afternoon, she was dead. Just 6 hours for the allergy of alcohol to wipe her right off the face of this earth after 22 years of sobriety. I said a minute ago, regardless of how long it took. I say that from podiums anymore because I look at these audiences, they keep getting younger on me all the time. I know it's because I'm getting so damned old, but a lot of times I think youth thinks they got here too soon. And if you're thinking like that, my God, forget it. The average age of death today of the guy or the gal with the disease called alcoholism is down to 37. Take a look around you. You see a lot of us old jokers still staggering around. So you know how many kids have got to be dying to bring it down to anything like that. It's not extraordinary at all anymore for somebody to go through the gates of insanity and death before their 16th birthday. Coupled with some of that crap that's out there on the street this morning, pushing this progression along, it's not hard to pack 20 years of hard drinking into 4 or 5. So if you are in a room like this morning, for God's sake, try to pay attention to some of these symptoms I'm going to try to describe. Some of these innermost feelings, and maybe, just maybe, you might save yourself a lot of hell right here on earth. And I'll get off of this bleeding deacon kick and qualify myself as an alcoholic. I like to get those licks in because sometimes we get carried away with these war stories and we forget what the real basis of this program is all about. I didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession. I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the fastest airplanes ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in what they call the Depression years. I know a lot of you aren't even old enough to remember them. Have a feeling you might have had a little touch up here lately. But things were tough. I knew our chances weren't that great. I started to investigate. It seemed to be my only chance. It had to be the military. So back in those days, we didn't have an Air Force for sale. It was part of what was called the old Army Air Corps. I found to get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment from the state to get into Randolph. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that college education. I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I stayed clean all the way through high school. It's out for football and basketball. I won my football scholarship to Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way, got my senatorial appointment. And they sent me to Randolph Field, which is the old Army Air Corps Academy. And they kept me real busy for the rest of my training. Through that period of my life, booze was no problem. I just didn't use it. I graduated as a second lieutenant back in the old Army Air Corps, just prior to us getting into World War II. I see a few guys sitting out there this morning can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. Our dads were supposed to fought one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to appropriate the kind of a show we've got today. We got tossed into that North African campaign over there right at the beginning of the war against a bunch of guys that had been sitting there practicing for a couple of years, and they got real good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under airplane. I found myself in a situation on that first tour, which a lot of times we were putting up 25 against 200. And we were getting a hell kicked out of us. I came back up on one of those raids very early in that first tour of duty. That particular day, we only got 8 back out of the 25. Now, I think a lot of you in here can identify with adrenaline, Mother Nature's drug, usually triggered by fear. Fear of death, fear of failure, fear of the unknown. You get a near miss out here on one of the interstates, you have handle it real good. You know, you get a half mile down the road, you can't keep your foot on the accelerator. That's adrenaline. I've been in nothing but an adrenaline-type situation for about 6 hours. Standing in an interrogation line, waiting to go in to talk to him about what had happened. Old Red was shaking. I was shaking in every bone in my body. Now, I wasn't too worried about adrenaline shakes. I'd had them a lot of times before. You stand there and wait for that football to come down, that 280-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I don't give a darn who you are. But you get in the game and you get over it. And I knew I'd get over it, but this flight surgeon standing there looking at me wasn't that sure. He says, "What's the matter, Ed?" I said, "Nothing. I'll be all right." He looked at me for a few minutes. He says, "Young man, I got just what you need." I had never paid any attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations. But on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey is a medicine. Reached over, he picked up a water glass, and he poured me about 2 fingers, and he said, "Here, drink this." And I looked at him and said, "I really don't want it." He looked me right in the eye, and he says, "Young man, I prescribe it." Man, I hung on to that, and for the next 20 years. I picked that stuff up, turned it up, drank it, walked on into interrogation, and sat down. If you got an alcoholic personality like mine, I know you know what happened. Man, that stuff sat there and flowed out there to those fingertips and out there to those toes, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting there real comfortable. I looked down, and they're roped. You know, 10 minutes before, I couldn't light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line with a half a glass of booze, I mean, I'm looking at them, and they're frozen, just like they are this morning. And literally, old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it. And booze worked for me that well for a long, long time. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it, I was going to have to keep recreating the kind of a situation I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. I became a combat freak. I stayed 3 years and 2 tours of duty. I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge, that fast lane. Booze was always there at the end of the day to handle anything that I couldn't. God, I'd come in at night and see guys sitting on the edge of their beds worried about going the next day. You know, and I'd look at them and think, geez, I wish they could find alcohol. It never dawned on me that it worked so much better for me than it did for them. I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But in retrospect, I think I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. Rather than laying it down, I went looking for a job that had some adrenaline in it. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that we got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in, got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command, and hell, the excitement was back. Flying the kind of airplanes that I'd laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. I was flying with the best. I knew it. Booze was still working for me. In fact, I think it started working just a little bit too well. Proving Ground Command is Eglin Field in Florida. Still is. They got a big officer's club built right out there in the Gulf there at Fort Walton. I used to catch myself an awful lot of nights hanging out at that club until 1 o'clock in the morning, just kind of tranquilizing the day. And I'd know I had a 6:30 test hop. Not always for sure. There was a while I'd wake up in that BOQ at around 10 o'clock in the morning with that cold sweat start we come to in. I look at my watch and say, did I or didn't I? You know, you pick up the phone and call the sergeant and say, did I get everything written up they wanted this morning? Yes, sir. Right down the line. You walk back down to the line, step upon the wing of that bird, the knee pad is yours. Checkoffs are yours. Signature's yours. Geometer says you've been up to speed of sound, and the only thing you can't recall is going. Another symptom of this disease. Don't kid me, it hasn't happened to you. You step out there on that porch in the morning, that car sitting in the driveway, you say, how did it get home last night? Overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with a mile of it. I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout. You'd never see them stagger. No conception of where they were or what they were doing. Should just scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever found one that had bothered too much. We write her off of the idea that, God, I must have had a good time last night. In the occupation that I was in, I knew it wasn't what I was looking for. I started my first feeble attempts at control. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. I figured if I was going to exercise control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. And I think this is how an awful lot of us become daily drinkers. You know, I gave up binge-type drinking, but I didn't give up drinking. I just strung it out. And it worked good for a lot of years. Most of the real good airplanes I'd wanted to test were off the drawing board anyway. I was looking for something that had a little more kick to it. As usual, the Air Force come up with it. We found out we'd let way too many guys out right after World War II. Started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. One of the promotional aspects to come up with was an organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Demonstration Team. Probably most of you have seen that team at one air show or another around the country. You don't get sentenced to that team, you volunteer for it. I had all the qualifications, I put my application in and I got accepted. It's not all fun and games, for sure. You practice at that stuff 4.5 days a week. At that time, we were flying 32 air shows around the country a year. They're up to 48 now. They only let you do it for 2 years, and it's probably enough because it's an adrenaline-building son of a gun, but I was back flying with the best again, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. I think maybe I started running into another symptom you might identify with. It's called hangover. God, I have never found, and this is before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. You just think about it for a minute. You walk out there in the morning, that canopy comes down over you, and you're trapped. There's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner tavern. That's for damn sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face, and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation and those guys just insist that you don't shake. You do a lot, maybe you might identify with this one, it's called the deep sweats. You know, I used to sit there and wonder how come something that's worked for me so well for so long is kicking me around like this. I used to try to analyze it. I got to thinking, hell, maybe it's the life you lead, Red. Maybe at the end of your 2 years if you'd resign. Get out, get in the civilian life, get a business going, get a family started. Do the things I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. Always believed right up until I had both feet through the gates of insanity and death, that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drinking. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grew up with in kids, where every guy and every gal should be an island to themselves, is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of those practicing alkies that are out there this morning self-medicate themselves right out of this world. But I will find in what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years. I resigned. I hit civilian life. All my buddies had been out there about 6.5 years ahead of me. They'd got out right after World War II. They'd gone back to school. They'd completed their educations. They had homes built, families started, positions. If you're anything like I was an alcoholic, you know what you're going to do. Double up and catch up. That's the way I hit civilian life. I went into business. I built a tri-level home. I got married. I started that family. The business I went into was immediately successful. I'd grown up in it. I've been in it most of my sober years. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. It was good. I think I'd have probably been all right if I'd have worked that at 8 hours a day, but I was working 12, 14, 16 hours a day. I went to 6 days a week, then I put on 2 shifts. I got that tri-level home down there paid for in a short period of time. Got a trust fund started for the kids to get them through college, and hell, we're only 1 in 3. You know, this is the way we think, and this is the way we drive, and I'd come through those doors at night, a beat I could hardly hold my head up. Flop in that easy chair, and there was one thing I could always sell red on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today, Tiger, you know what it was, a drink of booze. I was no better off than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. A strange thing happened to me about this time in my life. Oh, Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling him we hadn't trained any fighter pilots after World War II. He found it out in a hurry. He had to call the war worries. Got just 21 days from the day I was recalled. I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed each wing. Again, they're saying, sick 'em, Tiger. They just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. Yeah, I'm 30 years old by this time. Maybe it won't sound old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot, especially one with a progressive disease. I had no idea that I had a progressive disease. I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How can you have a disease? But when I started to do that 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to old Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. You know, I told you I'd been a daily drinker for an awful long time. I steal this from my wife's pitch, and I think you heard it last night. I think these chains of alcoholism lie so lightly on our shoulders that a lot of us have no idea that they're there until we're just completely enmeshed. Till all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we're no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Booze is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I went over to the PX, and I bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks, one for each winter flight boot. And hell, it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after booze started doing to me, it would still do for me. And I think a lot of you can identify with that. I was brought out very vividly to me just how hooked I was really getting. Long about my 40th mission, I got shot up again that morning for about the umpteenth time in my life, and the shell come through the bottom of the airplane and right through my left leg, and it kicked it clear into my chin. I got my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into that left winter flight boot. I still remember sticking my hand down there and pulling it back and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Only alcoholics identify with that story. I thought they'd shot my coming home jug out. I really had. I still had 30 minutes to make it home, and I was damn glad to find my medication still intact. Mine bleeding a little. It's the way alcohol let me think. I finished my 100. I got back here to the States. I figured, you know, maybe, Red, you could find yourself a flying job far enough away from booze. Maybe you can get someplace where it's not so readily available. As usual, the Air Force took care of it. We were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. I went north. If any of you are thinking about that, my God, forget it. I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold weather will not do it. It just won't do it. I finally volunteered to come on back down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery there in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there. Thule is only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I brought down a twin-engine airplane that afternoon. I loaded her clear down those big 40-ounce Canadian jugs of that CC and VO. I started back up there that night, and I got into one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in. And I lost an engine. It was one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. You know, I fought that thing all night. I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn, and the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? I rolled back that window, and the first thing they asked me is, you didn't salvo that load, did you? It never crossed my mind. I don't know whether you guys had this problem or not. As a daily drinker, I was beginning to smell like booze most of the day. I got to think, you know, maybe if I'd get back to Europe where they got that wine on the table and they eat a lot of garlic, that at least I'd blend in better. I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. I went back over. My northern run was Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Now, those are progressive disease towns. My southern run was Madrid, Casablanca, Iran, Algiers, Tunis, Huelis, Athens, and Rome. And it got worse in that direction. I was picking up a lot of rank over the years. They kept trying to trap me for command. They got it done. They jerked me back here to the States, sent me through staff and command school, gave me an air defense group, stuck me up at Hamilton just outside of San Francisco. God, now I got 800 men in my command. You know, I'd hear my airplanes roll every morning. Seemed like invariably, I'd look out there at that outer office of mine, and that adjutant would always have about at least a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. I found an awful lot of my mornings used to be taken up constantly. These kids had been in town getting themselves into all kind of trouble, most of it drinking. I had a system. I had an Izon safe alongside of my desk. I used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red vodka in there with a hooked glass straw. Every time he'd go out to get one of those boys, I'd hit the safe. Usually by noon, I was giving some pretty damn good lectures on the evils of drink. Also knew that sooner or later, I was going to get in an awful lot of trouble. The Air Force had always been awful good to me all my life. I figured I showed them a lot more than I'd been giving them lately. And again, I decided to resign. This time it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command at Colorado Springs. They reviewed it and bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that I be sent to Parks for 3 months psychoanalysis, one of the big Air Force hospitals. They thought I was suffering from delayed combat fatigue. I couldn't very well go in and tell them what I was suffering from. If I had any other terminal disease in this world, I'd have been in there on that doctor's doorstep every morning, laying the symptoms on him, you know, telling him, God, Doc, this is where it hurts. Yet you can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office, read him that same set of questions when it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now and then, Doc. Self-denial, the greatest symptom of all the symptoms I've been trying to describe. Our complete lack of our innermost selves to get honest enough to admit alcohol is just taking us to pieces. I had to spend that 3.5 months on that psychiatric ward. They couldn't figure out why a 15-year light colonel all of a sudden wanted to throw his command in. This was a long time ago that this help was offered to me. It was before alcoholism was even recognized as a treatable disease, especially by the military. I had to spend that 3 months on that psychiatric ward. I had 3 appointments with those doctors a week for those 3 month periods. The rest of the time I had open post. Now the club always opened at 12 o'clock noon, closed at 1. I used to open it every day at 12 and close it at 1. In the 3 month period that I was going through that psychiatric evaluation, there wasn't one time that those doctors saw me that I wasn't bombed out of my mind. And yet there's not one mention in that whole medical evaluation of the word alcoholism. You see, they didn't even recognize it as a treatable disease. They let me out. Families long since got tired of my shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out to the West Coast, and they'd been real successful. They had a big home over there on Palo Verde Hills, over there behind San Pedro. I figured I'll get up there in that big den with that boob tube and that beautiful blue view of Los Angeles Harbor. All the pressures I've been drinking at over a couple of wars are pretty well off my back. I'm going to get a handle on this drinking. I lasted about 2 weeks up there, and I was going out of my gourd. It was one of those big wooden globes, one of those Columbus-type globes sitting in that den. I kept looking at that thing and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys that had flown combat or gone to school with. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me, that I'd have to do it on my own. I ran my finger up over the meridian to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. That keen alcoholic thinking kicked in, and 1 month later I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. Halfway around the world again. Nobody knows Red. All he knows is he's got lots of flying time and he's qualified. I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether any of you guys tried white knuckle sobriety or not, but I stayed sober a year on guts. And if you're thinking about it, my God, forget it. It was the most miserable year I ever spent in my life, before or since. There wasn't a waking moment in that year that I didn't want to drink. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, go down to the kitchen, pour myself one, and set it on a table and sweat it. Not drink it. Prove yourself you got guts enough, Red. I'd go to a movie and have to get up in the middle of it and go to the bar and have the bartender pour me one. Not drink it. Sit there and sweat it. That's the way I went through the year. At the end of it, I figured, well, there's one thing you've proved, Tiger. At least you're not an alcoholic. And I went out to celebrate. Then my last fight. I don't remember ever fighting after that. You come up that hill so gradually, you hit that level off period. You finally get over on the backside of this alcoholic curve. I'll guarantee you, once you hit the backside of that alcoholic curve, you're going to start donating the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Jobs, securities, homes, families, things that we've worked hard for most of all our lives, we're going to start tossing them into the pot to reserve a right to use this drug. If you want to hang out there as long as Red did, you're going to start getting things like integrity, self-respect, anything that means anything to you on the backside of that curve. If you want to donate, you got to donate. I used to look down and say, if I ever got like that joker, I would quit. Pretty soon I'd be just like him, and I'd say, I mean that one down there. Down that hill I went. It wasn't too many years before they quit renewing my airline contracts. Africa, about this time, most of those colonial powers were going independent. I found there was a hell of a demand for the kind of flying I'd been doing most of my life. All of a sudden, I find old Red shooting at people for money. This has a funny effect on your insides. I'd always had at least principles to fight for through a couple of wars. Now I'm just sitting out there shooting at guys to support a habit that I don't seem to be able to do too much about. A lot of other pressures can be put on practicing alcoholics, as all of you know. I told you I'd been CO of an air defense group that helped build the radar sites and flown with the test division. I'd had a top secret clearance for 15 years, and now I'm flying for a foreign government. You hear things like OSI and CIA, you don't think too much about it, but I'll guarantee you they know where you are. And they can give up practicing alky fits. They know how much you're drawing. They know where you're banking it. They're opening your mail. Maintenance isn't worth a damn. You get shot down in that part of the world. All these pressures are building, and I'm doing the one thing that's always worked. I'm pumping that booze. And man, it got worse. It finally got so bad that they even quit hiring me for it. I ended up, and I'm sure as hell not proud of this, flying through mountain passes with my landing lights on railroad tracks for navigation. Now my flights are low level over water. My landing fields are deserted beaches, flashlight lit. I think you know what I'm doing. I'm smuggling because that's where the money is. That's where all the fears are, too. If I get caught doing what I'm doing now, I know they'll put me away for life. And yet alcohol took all those choices away. And if you want to hang out there as long as Red did, and you live, that's exactly what it's going to do to you. I kept right on with that kind of a crappy existence till I finally got so bad they even quit hiring me for it. I was back here in the States. I was 41 years old. I guess probably I was about as unemployable as a guy can really get. I figured there wasn't too many things I hadn't tried a couple times in this world, and if I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red Vodka, and I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde. And I went on what was supposed to be old Red's last drunk. And I just about made it. People over on the side of that hill had no idea what was wrong with me. I'd been out there among them since I was 18. They'd really never been around me that often. This was 32 years ago. It was before detox or care centers or hospitals that would have anything to do with an alcoholic. Those people knew I was getting awful sick physically. That drunk lasted 64 days. The last 30 of it I hadn't eaten. My normal weight's about 220. I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation. Most of that was liver. I think God stepped into my life at this time. Those people picked a doctor out of the phone book to see if he'd make a house call. And you know that doctor actually made that house call. I know today that he didn't do it because it was a Hippocratic oath. They happened to pick one that's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. He listened to those symptoms over that phone. He made that house call. He told those people what I was up against. Said he'd seen an amazing recovery on a program that he himself was trying. That he was going to do for what he could for me physically. And he was going to leave some names. And if I asked for help, to call you. I don't remember ever getting that well. He thought I was going to die and they thought I was going to die. So I guess they just called you. Because my first recollection of you sober guys were those guys sitting on the edge of that bed. And you know, they literally nursed old Red back to health. One of them is still my sponsor. They started hauling me into rooms like this. And man, you new guys look good this morning. I was a tongue-chewing, wet-brained, babbling idiot when they hauled me in. But thank God you read this portion of chapter 5 like they do before these meetings, because I think that's what saved Red's life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could hear, just don't drink today. And then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. All of a sudden, sitting at that old maritime meeting over there in Wilmington one Saturday night, about 30 days sober, they had just read that portion of chapter 5. And it all come crashing in, what I was trying to identify with. You see, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that had ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do to get through one flight was written down. And I'd never gone near a bird in my life, drunk or sober, that I hadn't used that checklist from the time I walked up until the time I walked away. And it'd get me through just one flight. Sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it dawned on me what 24 hours really is. 24 hours is just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps of the checklist to keep you from getting through it, to get you through it without ever picking up a drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist now on a daily basis for the last 31 years. I've never found it necessary to go back out there and pick up another drink of alcohol. Tranquilizing, sedating, elevating pill. Haven't had to smoke any funny grass. I've probably been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world. And I owe it all to you guys. On my own, I'd given it my best shot, and I'd never scratched the surface. Everything I've been talking about this morning, I've learned in rooms like this. If you got your hand up recently, and you said, my name is, whatever it is, and I'm an alcoholic, you pretty well got that number one step nailed. That's what we're talking about. We admit we are powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable. And that's just about what you're able to do when you hit your feet in front of a bunch of your peers and say, my name is Red, and I'm an alcoholic. Ain't like I was, though, when you hit that step number two, that thing will just jar the living hell out of you. There's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a power greater than old Red to restore me to sanity. You know, before I can take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. I got to admit I had to be. Where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug that if he continued to use it was going to kill him, then went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? There's got to be all kind of insanity in us before we ever come through these doors. Don't let it shake you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. For years, by the time I'd get my shop closed in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park where I live and change clothes and then double back up to the valley where I speak, I was always driving like a son of a gun through that traffic to get there in time. This guy was doing the same thing. He was on the freeway. His off-ramp was coming up. He only had about 10 minutes to make the meeting he was headed for. He hit the off-ramp, got a couple of blocks down the street, and blew a tire. He jumped out. Sure as hell, it's flat. He thought, well, maybe I can still make it. Run around, jerked his trunk open, got his spare out, jacked his car up, whipped his lug nuts off, put him in a hubcap behind him. He just setting his spare up. Car come whizzing along behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap and flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. He's frantic. He's out there beating these weeds to death. It's dark. He's wringing his hands. He knows he's going to be late. All of a sudden, he heard a voice. He hadn't paid any attention where he'd rolled to a stop. He looked up, and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates had been sitting up there on a fence watching all this. He says, hey, mister. The guy says, I haven't got time to talk to you right now. He says, I'm in a hell of a hurry. The guy sitting up on the fence says, you know, he says, I've been sitting up here watching you. He says, I figured you must be. He says, hell, if I was in that big a hurry, he said, I'd take the other three hubcaps off, take a lug nut off of each wheel, put that thing on there and get going. The guy looked at him and he says, my God, that's the answer. He says, how did you come up with that? I thought you were insane. The guy says, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid. What I'm trying to make, guys, is this. All of us, when we come through those doors, are a wee bit bent out of shape. We've been out there kicking ourselves around for a long, long time. The mere fact that we come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are, in rooms like this. Guys and gals sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other that we can solve this common problem. I hit that step number three, and I think all of you know what happened. I run into that word God. I went running for my sponsor, and I said, Mac, is that the God they're talking about? He says, yeah, Red. I said, Mac, I'm sorry. I got 250,000 years in purgatory to do before I could even start this program. I got the kind of personality that can walk by a swimming pool with some of these new suits that I got up there and pick up 25,000 years just going by. He says, Red, he says, you didn't read the small print. I said, what's that? He said, the God of your understanding. I knew I was going to have to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than Red because I had really loused it up. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that there was a power right there in front of me. You guys. Man, I could believe in group power. I'd been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in the group, I had all the firepower in the world. It was only when I was out there as a straggler I was going to get my ass shot down. I started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started listening to them. I started picking their brains. And they taught me real good about this power that today old Red calls God. My sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. What I do with that sobriety is my gift back to Him. See, He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started with that first 100 guys and a gal. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing here at the podium or at the door when the new guy comes through or the new gal. I got to share my experience, strength, and hope with them like they did with me when I come through that door. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got down to that number 11 on that checklist, and they got to talking about God's will for me. You know, and I'd been doing pretty good with that checklist, and I figured, even to this day, I never can get it straight why God's will and Red's will don't start to come together. You know, they just stay right on that same parallel ever since I come through the doors. Heard a story over in Vegas the other night, kind of illustrates what I'm talking about, Red's will and God's will. This guy must have been an alky. He'd been out there among them all during this last slow period we had. Finally get himself a good job in a supermarket in the produce department, keeping all the lettuce and tomatoes and vegetables and everything laid out, wet down, looking good. All of a sudden, one afternoon, this guy come walking through the door and cornered him. He says, "Young man," he says, "I want to buy half a head of your lettuce." The kid looked at him and he says, "I'm sorry, sir." He says, "We don't sell half a head of lettuce." The guy wouldn't get off him. You know, he stayed right in the middle of him. I can understand these kind of emotions. You know, he says, "Hey, I'm a bachelor." He said, "Look at the price of that stuff. It'd just go to waste. Sell me a half a head of lettuce." Kid stuck with his guns. He's getting a little irritated more all the time. And he says, "No, sir," he says, "we don't sell it that way." The guy wouldn't let up. He says, "Why don't you go back and ask your store manager whether he'll sell me a half a head?" By this time, the kid is really steaming, and I can understand those kind of emotions. You know, goes charging back into that store manager's office. He says, "There's some half-assed character out here that wants to buy half a head of lettuce." He turned around, and the guy had walked in right behind him. And he says, "And this gentleman here would like to buy the other half." See the difference between Red's will and God's? I got down to that 12th step. Said having had a spiritual awakening. And you know, nothing had happened. I got to go to a convention my first 60 days out in Palm Springs, California. I heard an old boy from the podium that weekend, and he sounded spiritual. He sounded spiritual every time I ever heard him after that. He passed away down Laguna a few years back. A lot of you know him. He's the author of A New Pair of Glasses. But I took him aside after that meeting, and I said, "Come on, Chuck, tell me about spiritual." He said, "I'm glad you asked, Red." He said, "I did a lot of research on it." He said, "I come up with a definition." I said, "That's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle." He says, "Red, spiritual is that which is not material." You know, I started reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out what that first 100 guys and the gal had in mind when they put that in there. And you know, the more I read it, the more I became convinced what they were talking about was my attitude and my emotions. These are the things that had always driven me back out there to pick up that first drink. Alcohol was merely a symptom of what was wrong with me. My attitude, prior to finding you guys, when I'd step out there and look at a day, was, "Oh God, another day." And it had been that way for a long, long time. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at a day and say, "Thank God, another day." The average age of death when I come through those doors was 41. And I told you a minute ago how old Red was. I just barely snuck in. Means that every day that I've been granted over the last 31 years on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. And you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I get up here to a podium like this morning, I get right up on cloud nine. I got to tell you my attitude story. This guy walked into a barber shop not too long ago. He was right up on cloud nine. Barber got him in the chair and he says, "What are you so happy about?" The guy says, "I got a 747 reservation going to Rome." He said, "I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food." He said, "I even got an audience with the Pope." The barber looked at him and says, "What's the matter with you, man?" He says, "That 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky." He says, "You'll be airsick all the way over there." So you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge is going to seem mild. He said, "You know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you." The guy had gone in there right on cloud nine. Now, he came out after that haircut right down in the pits, you know, right where those norms usually drop me. He didn't see him for 30 days, and all of a sudden, a guy come bounding through the door, and he is really out of sight this time. He got him back in the chair, and he says, "What now?" He said, "I made that trip." He said, "That 747 is the smoothest airplane in the sky." He said, "There wasn't a ripple going over." He said, "I gained 10 pounds eating that Italian food." He said, "The best I ever had." He says, "I even got my audience with the Pope." He said, "I got to kneel at his feet, kiss his ring." And he says, "Would you believe he even had a question for me?" Barbara looked at him and says, "What could he possibly ask you?" He says, "Where did you get that lousy haircut?" Don't let them tear you down, guys. I can't guarantee you get your wives back, your husbands back, your kids back, your jobs back, your health back. But I can guarantee you that those 12 suggested steps are going to give you the tools to start digging into that pile of stuff you brought through the door. And if you'll use them as tools, I can also guarantee you that you're going to start to uncover in a hurry something that you can live with awfully comfortable for as long as you want to hang around this program a day at a time. So much for attitudes. How about emotions? You know, in 5 different places in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it mentions the one thread, the one trend that seems to run through all our personalities as alcoholics is a little thing called emotional immaturity. How could a 41-year-old fighter jock be emotionally immature? You know, I had a hard time buying that in the beginning. I don't today, because over a period of the last 31 years, it's probably the one character defect that I've had to work on almost constantly. I looked up that word immaturity in the dictionary, and you know what it said? Childlike. From the very first time that that flight surgeon handed me that drink of booze in that interrogation line many years ago, my emotions had shut down. I had never had to grow up. I'd always had a crutch. It's brought out very vividly to me, out there in Buena Park where I live, every Saturday morning, exactly what they're talking about. And this has been going on for 31 years. Every Saturday morning, along about 9 o'clock, there's a knock on Old Red's front door. It's all the kids in the neighborhood gathered out there on my lawn wanting to know if I can come out and play. And I do. Every once in a while, my lovely wife there comes to the door and they look up and say, "Oh, it's Red's mother." I'm going to tell you right now, stand up so they can see you. Like all you new guys that have come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 30 or 60 or 90 days, I know that rather than listening to me too much, you're sitting there looking for the prettiest girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was doing the same thing. And thank God we got together. We've been together now married for 30 years of my 31 years of sobriety. If you noticed a minute ago, she was still standing when they said 35. That means she outranks me 3 years and 10 months on this program. And if you new guys or new gals are thinking about this emotional involvement, I would pick somebody that's got a little bit more sobriety than you have. Because over the years, it's worked out real great. Whenever I get into trouble, I say, "Well, give me 3 years and 10 months. I'll be all right." Whenever she gets into trouble, I say it seems like anybody with 3 years and 10 months more sobriety than I got would have grown more than that. But I think one of the greatest things that happened to both of us is we've grown up together. We've stayed active on this program. We've done the things that those 12 suggested steps suggest. And by doing them, we've become friends. You know, and it's very seldom you become true friends with the guy or the gal that you're married to. And that's what's happened to us, and we never let the sun go down with anything that's going to give us any trouble the next morning not taken care of. And it gets better, and it gets good, and it stays that way. So much for married life. How about those kids? See, I could never, ever figure out how I got along with kids like that. I have all my life. I realize today that the reason I always had is because their emotions were my emotions. I had never had to talk down to them. I talked directly to them, just like I'm talking to you guys this morning, and they know what I'm talking about. Did you ever see one of those little guys get mad? He gets red-faced, fist clenched, drawn back, swinging, angry, mad. Now, who does this remind you of? He'll pick up a resentment and he won't talk to the rest of us for the rest of the day. He's going to punish us. Anybody identify? You see, it's no wonder we come through these doors and start growing up together. Those kids and I have gone back through my teens together. Some of those kids that come knocking on that door have been doing it for over 30 years. Some of those kids used to put their wheels back on their skateboards, and now I'm helping Portland relieve their automobiles. And we still got a good thing going. And when they got in trouble with that crap that's out there on the street this morning, they knew where to bring themselves and their buddies. And I've had a lot of luck in that direction. And I'd have missed it. I'd have missed it all if it hadn't been for you guys. I still have an awful lot of trouble with that turn it over button. I don't know whether you guys have this trouble or not. Seems like after 31 years, Red would get real good at turning his will and his life over the care of God. And I don't have any trouble turning my will and my life over to the care of God, but I still have a lot of trouble leaving it there. You know, when it starts getting good, guess who wants to take the credit for it? And this program doesn't do it that way. You know, credit where credit's due. I'm going to close a little story. Happened to me just a few years back, just before I retired. Kind of illustrates the point that I'm trying to make. I got up one morning there in Buena Park. I had a whole bunch of situations down at the shop that morning. I really didn't want to go down and handle them. I'm still pretty good at procrastination. I haven't hauled around that house until I finally hit that 91 freeway going to Long Beach running late. Now, even to this day, when Red hits a freeway running late, strange things begin to happen. People do get cut out, horns get blown, fingers get given. You know, I'm building a head of steam. I haven't even got to work yet. Whenever I start to act that way, that old monster inside of me begins to lash. That one that used to whip me right over to that corner tavern. I got to run the checklist, and man, I hit that turn it over button, and it's froze in a down position. I haven't turned anything over to God. I said, okay, sir, I see what's wrong. I said, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You handle it. I got down there that morning. None of that stuff that I'd anticipated ever did come in. Everything that did come in was just as smooth as glass. You know, it was a nice day. It was a nice day all day long. Now, I jumped in that same car that night, headed back out 91 on my way home. Guess who I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation? All of a sudden, it dawned on me what I was doing, taking credit where it wasn't doing. I busted out laughing. And I looked over, and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway are tuning radios trying to find out what the hell I'm listening to. But it reminded me of a story that I used to use back in my combat days about credit, where credit's due. I had 6 clusters to my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me and they'd say, where in the hell did you ever get those, Rhett? I used to have a stock answer that I got pushed in the pond. The story goes like this. It's about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas, thousands of acres, big old Olympic-sized pool, a barbecue area, a rambling ranch house. just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150 yard across alligator pond. And he filled it with the meanest damn alligators he could find the world over. Those big old 15-foot snappers. And he didn't feed them too good. He kept them mean out there. All these guys got out there one afternoon drinking his booze and telling his war stories. And this Texan finally got a little tired of him. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, any of you guys really want to prove your courage? Anybody will go down there and swim across that alligator pond. He says, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine. Figured he'd shut him up for good. He no more turned his back. He hears all this commotion. He turned around and here this guy is swimming out across that pond, and he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster tail. He made it. The Texan run around helped him out. He says, I have never seen such a display of courage. He says, I'll stick with my bargain. He says, I imagine you want my daughter's hand. The guy shook his head and he says, oh, no, sir. He says, I'm already married. Texan looked at him and he says, well, he says, then it's got to be the $1 million. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, I have an income for life. He looked at him and he says, well, he says, then it's got to be the ranch like mine. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, my daddy left me one in his will. He looked at him and he says, well, what do you want? He says, I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond. You've been a great audience, gang. I've sure had fun. Just remember, every single one of us in this room this morning got pushed into that pond of alcohol. For sure, no human power could have ever got us out of there. God can and He will if He is sought. May you find Him now. May that power watch over us all, a day at a time, through the eternity of our spiritual existence. I sure want to thank you all for letting me share.